Welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror. I'm your co-host, Adam Wybray, alongside my co-host, Ren Wednesday. And today we've got a very special guest with us, Alex Aver, to talk about children's animated horror spectacular Over the Garden Wall. Enjoy!
Good evening, Adam.
Hello.
And good evening, Alex.
Hi.
Joined up by the power of a Discord group call. You've got a guest on this show to talk about Over the Garden Wall, which is very exciting. So one of our most loyal listeners. So Over the Garden Wall is a Cartoon Network miniseries from 2014. It consists of 10 episodes, each about 10 minutes long, and it follows two brothers, Wirt and Greg, as they travel through a mysterious wood called the Unknown, trying to find their way home. As you suggested this, Adam, so how did you come across it?
Oh, that'd be asking. ain't that just the way? That's going to be my get out clause, just quoting Greg saying, ain't that just the way? I don't know the answer to something.
Did you watch it when it was first?
I remember my friend Naomi got me to watch the first two episodes and I quite liked it, and then I completely forgot about it. Naomi was absolutely right that it'd be to my tastes, and then it slipped my mind. And I came back to it, and I just sort of remember, I wasn't quite sure if it was a kind of kids show or not, so I think I'd passed over choosing it for a few weeks, really, because I wasn't sure if it counted, but I think I'm very sure it does now.
Yeah. It's just turned up quite recently on European Netflix, so... It's a good time to get back into it.
Yeah, that's what triggered off the memory.
Yeah. And I'd sort of heard mention of it on Tumblr a few years back, but never watched it. And so this was the first time. And I watched it and thought it was great. And I told Alex to watch it.
And I watched it.
And here we are.
I think on Tumblr it probably coincided with the spoopy skeleton memes that were all the rage a few years back.
Yep, and it was about the same time as Gravity Falls as well, which I haven't seen either, but...
My gosh, I bet there's quite a lot of, like, Mabel and Greg fanfic, like, with them being friends. I'm going to have to research that afterwards. They're quite similar and similarly adorable characters.
Yeah. As usual, this episode will be full spoilers, so suggest that you go and watch it first if you don't want that.
And do really watch it, like, because it is genuinely wonderful. I had no idea what to expect when it was kind of recommended, and I just thought I'd turn it on, and it filled me with several bits of joy, which is really nice, particularly from a horror thing.
So the narrator in the first episode introduces it as somewhere lost in the clouded annals of history lies a place that few have seen, a mysterious place called the Unknown, where long forgotten stories are revealed to those who travel through the wood. And as that kind of suggests, the chapters in the stories are sort of fairly distinct, and they seem to happen in different time periods and different styles, but they're all sort of threaded together by the woods.
Yeah, it's a kind of overlaid palimpsest. Is that how you say it? That's a proper academic word. Palimpsest.
That is how you say it.
Yeah, yeah, one of those. It's like an overlaid collage of American history. But it is all kind of ye oldie, I guess. It's like Mark Twain.
Yeah, I'd say it kind of sort of like 18th century to like early 20th century in different locations where they go to.
Yeah.
And quite often mixed at the same time, like you get different, like a palimpsest, you are getting different layers at the same time. So you're getting kind of like jazz from one era mixed with like visuals from an entirely different thing, and like a kind of sensation of a much older world than that at times. And so it's very hard to place when the kids come from, even when we do see that.
Yeah, and I think it's quite... I mean, this is a bit early to be giving anything away, but I was quite surprised when they come from a time period much closer to our own than I expected.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, because you find out that they're dressed in Halloween costumes, but this kind of obscures what time they're from for quite a while. So sort of just wearing these sort of odd fairy tale costumes.
And I guess the way they speak that were sort of speaks like kind of romantic era poet, and Gregory sort of speaks in, I don't know, odd truisms or like, I don't quite know how you describe Greg's speech patterns.
Very quite particular way of speaking and singing half the time
as yeah well. Like he kind of speaks in like the kind of slogans you'd imagine on a packet of like 19th century cough drops.
One of the things I like about him is that he kind of has a tendency to pick up phrases and things from other people. So he'll say something that someone else has said in like a very different tone and a very different situation. And it's really, I don't know, I like it. I like that kind of like trying to make sense of the world by picking up on what other people are saying. And yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. There's one particular bit where is just like demanding like kind of run. And then, like, Greg doesn't, because Greg doesn't do what Wert says very often, but does some other stuff. And then a few moments later, Run does exactly the same run, and he's going, run. And it's just, like, a statement of fact, as in, like, running, I am running, rather than a call for people to run. And, like, things like that, I think, are really, really sweet about him.
Yeah. So they also have, as their sort of... companion, she has a bit ambiguous, but a bluebird called Beatrice, who halfway through the series reveals that she used to be a human, but after throwing a rock at a bluebird was cursed along with her whole family to turn into birds. It turns out she's when they meet her, she's she promises to take them to Adelaide of the Pasture, the good lady of the woods, to help them find their way home. But in chapter 6, it turns out that Adelaide is a witch who wants a child servant in exchange for the embroidery scissors that will turn Beatrice and her family human again. And she's been leading them to that.
And you can tell that Adelaide is a witch because... she has a giant Miyazaki head, like the witches in Spirited Away.
Yeah. yeah, both her and Auntie Whispers are very like the Spirited Away witches.
Yeah, like each episode, I think, is broadly based around the style of a different... animation studio. So that episode is broadly the Studio Ghibli episode, and you can tell because the kids have to do housework And Miyazaki is very keen on children doing hard labour around the house. And then, like, one of the earlier episodes with the Highwayman, who is one of your favourites, right?
Oh, God, I love the Highwayman.
It's very much a Fleischer studio, so Betty Boop tribute. So why do you like the Highwayman?
It's just so odd. I just, because they go to a kind of
tavern,
a tavern, like an early 18th century tavern, approximately.
I was totally believing your historical authority.
and all the people in the tavern have jobs, and they're like, I'm the tailor. I'm the midwife. I'm the doctor. And then this guy is like standing on the stage and he goes, I'm the highwayman. And then Wed's like, okay. And then he launches into this bizarre little song.
Quite dark little song as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like a murder ballad or something Tom Waits would sing.
Yeah. And it ends with him.
It just kind of blurs back and forwards on the stage repeatedly throughout the whole.
Yeah, the animation goes super distorted, and his sort of face like looms forward and then like slinks back, and he kind of just sort of shifts around the stage in this really odd way. And it ends with him sort of making this like throat slitting gesture at Wirt.
Yeah, it's like a Betty Boop cartoon but somehow rendered in 3D, but with 2D animation techniques, which is impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just really hypnotising. Did you watch it on repeat? Yeah, I did. I got to that part in the episode, and then I went to YouTube and just found that clip and watched it a few more times. Yeah, love that.
I really like that episode in general, just because it did have lots and lots of little short songs that all told very, very odd narratives about what was going on in that tavern. Like the kind of when. They decide that Wirt is the lover and that's his role to take in the town, and then decide to just base the entire economy of the town on the fact that there's going to be a wedding, and it's all right. Everyone's got a job. Everyone's got a role to play. And getting Wirt married and getting this marriage to be like the ultimate celebration, and like, it really does feel like that they finally found their purpose. I love that.
It's work for all when little boys get married.
I like the songs are really perfectly pitched because they're sort of convincing as like 18th century ballads, but then they're always just slightly awkward, but not so awkward that they're not memorable. Like, they're genuinely quite good songs, but then they're always just a little bit off, or the phrasing is just a little bit bad.
Yeah. Yeah, because quite a lot of them Greg makes up on the spot.
Yeah, but he's always kind of singing ditties to himself.
Yeah. I did have potatoes and molasses in my head for a couple of days.
I only spotted today that at the very end, during like part of the climax, one of the little bits of like choral dramatic music coming is O Potatus et Molasses.
Yes. That's great.
It's a lovely touch. And yeah, one of the things I thought about Greg is that, like, you notice it in the Adelaide song, and like even he spots it in the Adelaide song, is that like he's quite fond of doing that thing where just like a perfect rhyme scheme throughout and then just suddenly completely missing it and getting completely wrong rhythm on the last line and just kind of reveling in it. Like, I like it.
I mean, I guess if we talk about the dynamic between the two main characters, that's the main difference, that Greg has this attitude summed up by his, ain't that just the way? that he, you know, he doesn't let stuff get him down, and he's plucky and does his best. And whereas obviously Wirt is a bit of a worrywart and sort of agonizes in great tortured poetry about you know, being lost in the woods and not knowing what to do.
Yeah. I really liked from going back and kind of watching again, like the fact that they start off, like immediately you've got Greg listing off 100 names that would be a terrible name for a frog, and Wirt just completely out of nowhere just launching into this enormous tirade about how awful the world is and how he's lost and at sea, and yeah, I don't know, just that kind of like over poeticness, and it just like it sells them instantly as characters, but you've got no explanation for it, but you do get that explanation as time goes on, and yeah, I don't know, I like it.
Yeah, and the difference in their outlooks is quite key to the story as it goes on. Because of the plot about the woods and the elderwood trees and the beast. So we're introduced to the elderwood trees in the first episode, and we meet the woodsman who grinds them for oil and he uses to keep his lantern lit. And he's kind of an ambiguous figure for most of the series, because he lives in the woods, and they're always like very heavily shadowed, and sort of the screens are very vignetted when they're in the woods. At one point, Wirt accuses him of being the beast himself, but it turns out he's actually sort of being controlled by the beast, or sort of being manipulated by the beast. The woodsman, he believes that the soul of his daughter is kept in his lantern, and he has to burn the elderwood trees for the oil that will keep it lit to keep her alive. But we find out that the elderwood trees are actually people who've lost hope and died in the woods. And so we kind of see their kind of twisted branches and gaping mouths. And it's very, I thought it was very reminiscent of in Snow White, where she runs away through the woods and they're all like clutching at her clothes.
I didn't notice that, but yeah, I mean, it obviously a lot of the animation harks back to early Disney.
So yeah, the woodsman's been grinding up these lost soul trees for years to feed the lantern that he carries through the woods, and believing that he's been keeping his daughter alive. But in fact, it's kind of the Wirt realizes right at the end that the spirit of the beast himself is alive in the lantern. And he's just been feeding the beast.
So what is the beast?
Well, it's a question.
Philosophically speaking.
Yeah. Any ideas?
My stock answer is just capitalism. I don't think that's necessarily the one here.
he has antlers, right?
Yes, he's a sort of tall, cowled figure with antlers. So a bit like the forest spirit in Princess Mononoke, albeit more obviously malevolent.
There's a glimpse of the beast in the flashing of the lantern right at the end, in which like I thought I was seeing like a load of like kind of a mass of octopus tentacles rather than anything else, and was quite shocked by that. But it was just like half a glimpse. It might have just been like a frame or so.
Semi-subliminal image.
Yeah. There was definitely something there with those with little round suckers and suction on it. And I think that I think that The Beast is this thing that kind of like gets caught on you and stuck. Like the way that the trees kind of grow out of the grow around people if they sleep too long or they stay too long or they lose hope is, I think that that's exactly what The Beast is supposed to be throughout here.
Yeah, the Beast, perhaps, I don't say it represents depression, but I suppose succumbing to despair.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat similar to the Swamp of Sadness in Neverending Story. You remember the memorably horrible scene where the horse gets drowned in the swamp. The quote is everyone knew that whoever let the sadness overtake it would sink into the swamp. And I think it's kind of a similar idea with the woods and the beast. They get various warnings from different people about they get a warning from the woodsman that they have to not lose hope, and they get warning from a woman in the tavern as well, in the form of song. she sings, "Once your will begins to spoil, he'll turn you into a tree of oil and use you in his lantern for to burn."
It's a nice potential misdirection, because that does suggest the woodsman.
I think they're singing about the beast, though.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. But I can see how...
Yeah.
At that time in the story, you hear that as being about the woodsman.
Yeah.
But actually, it's entirely accurate for the beast as well, because it is the beast spirit in the lamp. So it's one of those nice things to catch on the second time round.
Although the beast himself seems to be quite a happy fellow.
you hear him sort of singing in the woods, singing quite jollily.
saying all sorts of fairly esoteric, morbid things like, "La la la, as your life stream uncoils," and so forth.
Yeah,
which is all a bit Goblin King from Labyrinth, actually.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it is, you've actually. Got a
little,
I can't remember the tra-la-la line, but there is a tra-la-la line.
He sings a kind of hymn at one point. A kind of, like he's kind of evangelizing his way. He's like, "Come, wayward souls, and wander through the darkness. There is a light for the lost and the meek. Sorrow and fear are easily forgotten when you submit to the soil of the earth."
It makes death sound pretty tempting.
But yeah, if you've got him pretending that the woodsman's daughter is in the lamp the whole time, then you have got this idea of grieving, like quite heavily got pushed at by that, you know, this idea that you must make sure not to like take the lives of others and lose your own life in the kind of like the misery of giving up that is quite natural in a grieving process.
I read a blog article online by Krista Amira Calvo, who writes about Over the Garden Wall, children, death, and the mystery of the unknown, and argues that it's unusually death positive children's programme. I couldn't decide if I agreed with that or not, because on one level it's all about not giving oneself over to death, but at the same time death is situated as being part of the natural order of things. And so in an early episode they obviously go to a village of pumpkin heads who seemed to be engaged in some kind of midsummer ritual, perhaps, or harvest ritual.
Yes, it's a husking bee, which is a natural event where people husk corn together.
Ah, nice.
Yeah.
That seemed to me vaguely reminiscent of the Wicker Man, I suppose, is what I immediately yeah. thought of. And it turns out that, because as we all know, pumpkins can't spring to life and dance around. They need some kind of animating principle, which turns out to be skeletons, because as Tumblr lets us all know, the skeleton is inside you.
Classic memento mori.
And the skeletons are all quite happy being skillabubs and dance around quite merrily, and Wart decides that he doesn't want to stay in this place, take their leave of them, and then he's informed by the chief skeleton pumpkin head, don't worry, you all come to us in the end, or something.
I could make an argument for that episode in particular being death positive, because they are having like quite a good party in there. Like, it's only the misunderstanding of there being some living people there that leads to any fuss. And actually, all they do is ask to help them, you know, dig up some more graves, but not in a nasty way.
Although it's quite a dark moment, obviously, in the series, because Wart thinks that, they're digging their own graves to presumably be killed and buried in.
Yeah.
Mafia style.
It was definitely around that point that I was starting to think about the fact that, like, the show is incredibly dark and has a lot of really savage and, like, haunting and, like, genuinely threatening images. But because of the pace that it's got, it never lingers long enough to actually be scary. Like, it doesn't do it. It just immediately moves on to the next thing. In a way that I think kind of makes it quite safe and quite friendly while still having this kind of core of real genuine horror, which I quite liked.
Yeah. That's a nice way of putting it.
When you mentioned that to me, Alex, and then I sort of made on my second watch, I kind of jotted down some of those sort of moments that I noticed. Is there, like, in the Quincy Endicott episode where they go to a grand manor house to try and get some money to ride the ferry, and they meet Uncle Quincy Endicott, who believes that he's seen a ghost.
Voiced by John Cleese.
Which, as well as Adelaide, Adelaide also voiced by John Cleese. It's a slight digression, but I thought it was really good. And I was kind of surprised because
it's easy to be quite disappointed in John Cleese these days.
Yeah.
It was definitely good to not notice that it's John Cleese and not be suddenly overwhelmed by that presence in the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tim Curry as well as Auntie Whispers.
What? I knew I should have looked up the cast list on IMDb.
Yeah.
Well, classically stealing the scene entirely, as he is incapable of not doing. Oh, Auntie Whispers makes me shiver. It was her mouth, like the kind of like black gooey kind of mass of her mouth was genuinely haunting. And sucking the marrow out of a tiny dark turtle. Yeah. I'm very happy that that's Tim Curry.
So what was the moment in the John Cleese of the Manor episode?
There's a bit where I don't know what they're talking about, but he's talking about his money or something, and he sort of looks down and he goes, "The things these filthy hands have done to make this money." Not followed up on, just...
That's the dark nature of capitalism.
And Adelaide, when she captures Greg and Wirtz, she just sort of throws off, so once I fill their heads with wool, they become just like little sheep.
Yeah. I did write that line down. It is, ooh.
That's very other mother from Coraline.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also Auntie Whispers telling Lorna to her sort of stepdaughter to sort the bones of the people who've been eaten in the house before.
Yeah.
But it's very
much a hobby.
It's very much this sort of fairy tale darkness, though, where it's quite matter of fact that these dark aspects are just part of this world. And you don't get too caught up on them, as you said, Alex, that they're just sort of another part of the rich tapestry of life.
Yeah.
Do you think, would you have liked it as a kid, do you think, Ren?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm pretty sure I would.
I would have loved it. I kind of grew up with my dad making the family listen to like a constant stream of Gershwin and Cole Porter musicals and kind of like old trad jazz and like particular kinds of music that like definitely set me up for this show to be like absolutely like just hitting me right in the buttons all of the time. Yeah, still my favorite moment is the in Lullaby in Frogland, where they've just got just the song on the steamboat with the frog and the bassoon, and like everything is just absolutely perfect about that scene. And just the kind of the like, it's a big like character moment for Wer as he realizes that people actually might want to hear him play the clarinet. And yeah, and seeing the frog, who is George Washington at that point, let loose with like incredibly sweet singing voice and just this beautiful, like slightly haunting theme, name checking the whole series, and just, yeah, it's a really good centerpiece in there, and it's very me.
So should we talk a bit about how things are resolved?
Yeah.
As in the spoiler.
Yeah, so do you want to go, Jean?
No. by all means, you're good at, you're better at explaining plot than I am.
You say that, but I've my mind's sort of gone blank.
So what are we talking about? Are we talking about the Into the Unknown episode or the actual finale where
it
loops back? I guess you need to do both, don't you? Because so basically, there comes a time when all hope is lost, effectively, and the scene's got pretty nasty, actually, in the woods itself, and so we just pop to a separate pop to an episode where we're in the real world and kind of before the start of the show happens
of the 1980s.
Yeah, well, yeah,
or 70s.
Maybe
70s. Or later.
No, I don't know.
Why didn't she have a tape player? She didn't have a tape
that's
player.
That is a good point.
I totally think Wert is anachronistic enough to still be making mixtapes with clarinets and poetry, like, right to this day.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's possible.
But yeah, so in the modern era, we see that Wert's actually pining for a girl at school who is the school mascot, and it's Halloween, and the cops are trolling all of the kids, and Greg is just doing everything possible to support Wert in getting together with is it Sarah?
Yeah.
And Awat is like absolutely not having any of it and just failing at every turn and blaming Greg. And generally, I mean, I presume it would be awful if anyone like hears your kind of mixtape of clarinet and poetry at that age. Like, I do think he's got a genuine reason to be scared.
Wirt is quite the clarinet player, as it
we do, out. Yeah, I guess we
I
do
mean,
know
he
that.
Just like whipped out that bassoon playing, you know. He didn't even know how to play the bassoon. So he's probably some kind of clarinet prodigy.
Must be.
Yeah.
Woodwind extraordinaire.
Yeah. But yeah, I think this is kind of part of the sort of the theme of showing sort of Wirt's character about how he kind of gives up on the idea of asking Sarah out, sort of without even trying, as he hears that Jason Funderburker is going to ask her out, and then he just gives up. And I think that's kind of sort of ties in with when he just kind of gives up in the woods.
Even despite the fact that Jason Funderburker talks like this.
Yeah, Jason Funderburker has a interesting voice.
So Sarah, and Jason Funderburker and co go off for an age-appropriate juice party in the cemetery.
Yes, and they are actually drinking juice. sort of Wirt kind of sneaks along, kind of trying to get his tape back without letting them see him.
Despite having a very heavily laden hint that he should definitely be there from Zara.
And a very pointy hat.
Yeah. But they see him, and then the cops come into the graveyard and say, "Oh, yeah, kids, yeah, you're all under arrest." And so they start running away, and the cops like, "Oh no, we're joking," but they run.
But yeah, as cop pranks go, it just ends in misery and pain.
Yeah, and they. They climb over this wall, which is the garden wall of the title, because the graveyard's called the Eternal Garden, and fall over onto the other side. There's an oncoming train. Depending on how you feel about the series as a whole, they maybe die.
They definitely go underwater for long enough to kill a couple of children.
Yeah, they roll down a hill, land in the lake, and then right sort of at the end, they're dredged up out of this lake again. It's
quite odd how that happens as well, because you can jump from that moment to the very beginning of the show and it follows on exactly, you know, you've got that's where you have Greg finding the frog and deciding that his next quest is to find a name for the frog. And you've got Wirt having this kind of like dark graveyard of the soul and getting incredibly upset. And he starts immediately soliloquizing about like how awful that is. But in this moment, it kind of jumps into like the nest of the bluebird family that Beatrice has left behind. So it took me a while to notice that it had kind of jumped to the present of the story at that point, the present in the unknown at that point. And I was wondering whether they'd just fallen into a tree somehow. And it took me a while to realise that the time shifts back.
And
yeah,
we see them wake up in this hospital bed, but then... there's the intimation that this journey was real. It's a bit like Narnia in that sense, I suppose.
Yeah, it has the sort of thing where they've carried something back from this other, possibly dreamlike world, which is the Auntie Whispers bell in this case, which she uses to control Lorna, who has a demon inside her, but the frog, who is eventually named Jason Funderburker, because Greg once worked to name the frog, and all through the series Greg's giving the frog different names, but it's only officially named once Wirt names him. Jason Funderburker swallows the bell. And
who,
at the end...
me?
And in the end, the frog has the bell inside him in the hospital wing.
The frog's also got the stockings that were being put on him by his manager. Which feels like a very odd point to bring back at that moment. But yeah, suddenly to have a top bat and stockings on the frog in the real world is an odd one.
I think it's doing this David Lynch thing, like, What a Heart, or especially like the most recent season of Twin Peaks, where it's not trying to say that one's reality and one's fantasy, that they're both meant to have equal credence or equal levels of reality. So, you know, we see things wrap up in the fantasy world, with Beatrice transformed back into a human, etc. I don't think this is meant to not exist per se, or if it, you know, it has just as much value or truth or existence as the what we'd consider to be the real world.
Well, like when like the kids are walking into the graveyard, they're chatting about I don't have the exact quote here, but they say, they're saying something like, Sarah's like, oh, but, you know, should reality be decided by what humans can imagine or something?
No, you're limiting the possibility of human imagination is the unusual comeback there.
Yeah, so I think that's a little nod to sort of how we should consider the reality of the unknown part.
Radically pluralistic.
I think it's definitely all true.
I'm willing to
commit to that. I don't know about the rest of the world. But yeah, no, it all has a lot of truth in it, in a way that pleases me quite a lot. One of my little geeky, like, again, freeze framing and looking at a thing spottings was that one of the gravestone that Wirt hides behind when spying on Sarah and everybody and Jason Funderburker's terrible, sleazy ghost story, is the grave of Quincy Endicott.
Yes. Ooh. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So there's definitely an argument to be made that the unknown is a kind of afterlife, if you fancy making that argument. And there's also, like, when the train's coming towards them, you sort of there's a snatch of a Woody Guthrie song, that's where the train is representing death, and it sort of comes for everyone in the end. There's a lot of references to death. Is what I'm saying.
And I mean, I don't want to go full lost on anyone, but like I would understand a reading of it that painted the unknown as being a purgatory and actually the hospital being a heaven where everyone's reunited and things have worked out perfectly. Although, yeah, I don't like that reading, but I could I could understand it being made, and like the case is definitely there.
It's a bit like the argument you see online about My Neighbor Totoro. And Totoro being a deaf spirit, and that the two children that Mai does actually drown in the lake in the film. I mean, I don't think Miyazaki necessarily wants us to think that that's what's happened, but I can understand how you'd come to that conclusion.
Hmm. Yeah.
If you're a goth.
Shall we do our textures of the week?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Can I jump in before?
Yeah, please.
I just want to say that the animators in the show like love dogs.
Oh yeah.
It's really clear because they make the most like perfectly immaculate observation about dog movements that I've ever seen in anything.
there's one, the first
Ain't That Just the Way, where Greg has turned an evil monster into a friendly dog that's gonna be his best friend forever, and the way that dog slopes off is perfect. Like, absolutely, that is a dog sloping away. And then in the episode in the school, like all of the animals are kind of tucked up in bed, and then the last dog
just sort of curls up onto the bed.
But does that like walks around, does a little circle around before curling up? Like they just have to inspect the whole space, and it's just like that is 100% what Charlie does when he decides he's going to curl up in a ball somewhere. And even like the third one of these was for me was in Greg's dreamland, where they briefly see the fourth welcoming committee that is just an enormous sour-faced dog with a tiny towel over its head. Like, even Charlie, like the who I think Ren may be able to testify is like one of the happiest dogs you will ever meet. Like, when Charlie's just looking sadly up at you, it is the saddest thing. And that image just conveyed that perfectly. So I just want to say they are good at dogs.
Oh, that's good. This is why we have guests on the show to talk about things like dogs that
is that outside of my realm,
outside of our
I wasn't gonna let it go with you just once again forwarding your only cat's agenda.
important.
Although actually on the cat agenda front, I do really love like one of my favourite moments in the kind of flash into like kind of our world or the modern world. The reference, like the guy standing outside the party saying, there's of course there's lots of other ball games, you know, one old cat, two old cat, stool ball. just that cat, that jump back to two old cat, the game that you assumed was made up by Greg on the spot.
Which is where you find one old cat and then you find another old cat. And then...
and we don't know what happens next because that cat was too old for two old cat.
I'm sure over the Garden Wall conventions, this game is much played.
Yeah, I hope so.
Right.
Extra of the week.
It's quite an ambient one, that one.
I forgot I was supposed to sing, I'm sorry.
you sang fine.
Who wants to go first?
I want to jump in and get the highwayman's face before anyone else tries to. Sorry.
But no, what is that like elastic flesh?
Just that, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that you can only really do animated where it kind of like maintains coherency throughout the whole thing, but just different elements swell forward and kind of push and kind of suck at each other. And it's just very vivid, and like with that kind of like Cab Calloway backing, it's just so just very evocative, and I found it quite disturbing and quite unsettled. I like to think that I'm old enough to deal with songs about highwaymen. But apparently not when they've got a face like that. But no, it was just just a strong, overwhelming kind of like texture of movement, and I liked it.
I found the Well, actually, I think the texture that you won't know, Ren, but in the pilot for Over the Garden Wall, they meet a man. Can you remember his name, Alex?
Oh, I wrote it down. Give me one moment.
But it's a man made out of vegetables.
He was called John Crops.
Old John Crops. He was a humble man, and a man of vegetables. And he had a vegetable car, which had very satisfying, because it looked really sturdy, like a car should be, but also really kind of wet and engorged. Like, I don't know. It was, yeah.
I sitting in that must have been the most unpleasant thing. There's a vivid texture as they all climb into this like lump of watermelon flesh. But they all seem quite happy. I thought when you mentioned that episode, actually, I thought you were going to actually say John Crops' voice, which I love, because it's kind of, it has a sound effect that makes it sound as if it's been run through like an old 78 record or recorded into an old radio box, which is just such a, it's a lovely little detail. And yeah, the sort of thing that, it was one of the reasons why I particularly enjoyed that little bonus short episode, which I recommend digging up.
How about you, Ren?
So I was going to say the shoots of the Edelwood tree growing around Wirt and Greg when they're
you're such
over.
A morbid chap.
But I have a happy one as well.
Okay.
Kind of, which is Greg's eyes like popping through the skin of the drum, like on the paddle steamer when he has the drum on his head and then his eyes just kind of pop through
just entirely inexplicable. From that moment on, Greg is a drum. Hitting himself in the face to kind of make sure that the song goes on.
I did like his demands. Hit me in the face.
Drum me in the face.
Another moment in that scene is the how upset the frogs are at the absence of a bassoon.
And the way they waggle their tongues.
And kind of distress at it.
There's a whole paddle steamer full of dressed up frogs just sort of wailing and stamping their feet, so the fact they don't get to hear the bassoon, which is quite
hot
delightful.
Dog, those frogs really love the bassoon.
Any other general observations?
Just because we mentioned that, I just want to continue. I just love a frog chorus. I do love a frog chorus. It's one of my greatest faults in many ways. Just the perfection of that scene and how beautiful it is, and the kind energy of going down that thing, and then the end of that episode being the kind of complete breakdown of the group as Beatrice betrays everyone. I don't know. It's wonderful. You think it's a very special show.
I heard fragments of that.
Yeah, me too.
But I'm sure when I listen to the edit, I will be moved by the profundity of your statements.
the core quality's not been great.
I think we struggled through, and
I just wanted to give a little oh, it's Melanie Lisinski who's in Heavenly Creatures.
Oh, really?
Yeah, little Melanie Linsky.
Who's she voicing?
She Beatrice.
Oh.
But she's not using her New Zealand accent, so.
Oh wow!
You wouldn't know it was her.
No.
Yeah.
Well, that's good, because she's very good in Heavenly Creatures, and I haven't seen her in much. I know she has done things since, but.
She's very good in this too. I think that Beatrice is a great performance of someone like I don't know, watching the second time round and pulling off being quite mean to her in quite valid ways. I think, yeah, I like Beatrice a lot. Even yeah. though the second time around I was trying to kind of hate her for the betrayal, like, yeah, it just felt it felt more justified than I would have expected. Yeah, by that performance.
Yeah, I don't think she really knew what she was doing.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
and there's an odd joke at the end that because her mum has been a bluebird for quite a while, she keeps calling food dirt afterwards.
Yeah, not convinced bluebirds eat dirt, but
yeah, that whole thing is quite strange. I did like Wirt eating his dirt when asked by.
Yeah.
And
the moment that the eating leaves at the end as well is quite a nice line. It's like that because it's quite a horrific moment when
oh no,
you've the trees have started growing through you and you're spitting out leaves. It's like, nah, I was just eating leaves.
I watched this with my sister and that really floored my sister. Made her laugh loads.
Yeah, we hadn't heard any Phoebe.
Phoebe comments. Phoebe comments mostly that she just really loved Greg, basically. especially, yes, the revelation that Greg wears a teapot on his head as part of an elephant costume.
Yeah.
And she said she really also liked Wirt's comment that his secrets are too secret to divulge. Right, should we do credits?
Yeah, do you want to tell people where they can find you, Alex?
So I am Alex Ava, and you will find me on Twitter at AlabasterC, and Instagram at AlabasterCrippins, and in Hebden Bridge occasionally, although it'll probably be a bit weird if you show up and just say, I heard you on that podcast. And just have to find me first.
Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, our outro music's by Joe Kelly, and our artwork's by Letty Wilson. And you can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod, or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com, although we've yet to have a real genuine person do that.
What does that mean?
Oh, it's just been like adverts and like
people you don't know, like bots are pretty advanced now, they can listen too.
Okay. Hello all our bot listeners, I hope you enjoyed it.
Hello bot listeners. sorry,
don't mock them.
All right,
they've got the Russian government on their side. Sorry, bots.
I've decided I'm just going to, like, stop tormenting you by trying to make you come up with a sign-off on the spot.
Oh, man, that's just the way.
Yeah, that was what I was going to do. Oh, Alex, you're too quick. No, foiled.
Ain't that just the way, spooky kids?
Ain't that just the way.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.